Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next, you need the team to act on feedback fast. So you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/retro now for a free business plan trial to unlock advanced retro tools like private mode, voting, and two-way Jira syncing. That's Miro.com/retro now.
The Anton Savage Show
with Kiries.ie
on News Talk.
With me is Peter Leonard, barrister and presenter of the Fifth Court, Ireland's legal podcast, Niamh O'Reilly, freelance journalist, and Valerie Cox, journalist and author. Valerie Cox is having GPS problems with her dog. The reason we know Valerie Cox is having GPS problems with her dog is Jess Kelly, who is our technology correspondent, is also in the room, which started a discussion around devices. And Valerie has concerns that the dog's GPS is declaring it to have left the house when it's in its bed. Is that correct?
Well, yes. The GPS alerted me to say the dog was 1 kilometre away. And he wasn't. He was asleep in bed.
All of which is a total aside from the reason that everybody is here. Niamh, Peter and Valerie are here because there is much in the papers that we are going to be looking through, including some very interesting Sunday Independent polling. But the reason that Jess Kelly is here is because if you have been listening either to the Pat Kenny show when I was talking to Kathleen McNamara from Off the Ball about it, or if you were listening to The Hard Shoulder when Kieran was talking to Jess Kelly, or Jessica, as her name badge very formally calls her, for the Dublin City Mini Marathon. You're in the Mini Marathon today.
I am.
Fierce excitement.
Fierce nerve-wracking. In 2.5 hours, myself and 25,000 other women are going to take to the streets of Dublin and we're going to do 10 kilometres. I got the Lewis into town this morning and normally I have my headphones in, I'm in my own little world, but I took them out and the atmosphere on the Lewis of women coming in to town to get ready for this was actually a bit emotional. They were all talking about the causes, the training, the camaraderie. And you realise I'm running it for the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, but there's so many other causes that people are doing it for. And they're doing it because charities have helped them or their families or their loved ones. And it kind of made my heart happy to realise that we're such good people. Like, not just me.
Humble too. That's the main thing.
Humility is my middle name. But like the Irish people, we're such good people going out and doing something on a Sunday of a bank holiday weekend to raise money for organisations and charities that need it.
How do you feel about the weather? Because my understanding, Kathleen was saying she wanted rain. Well, she wanted kind of soft, a little bit overcast, not roasting hot. It's quite toasty and nice out there.
I was sweating buckets on the walk from the Lewis to here. So I'm very apprehensive. You see, my training, and I'll say that in quotes, has been done here in Ireland where we've had wind, rain, ice, bit of snow, bit of everything else. We haven't had sun. So where is this sun coming from? And why is it choosing today to come out and play?
You go Stephen's Green out past UCD, down past the Radisson.
Exactly. You turn around, then you are going down Nutley Lane, Marion Road, and then back into town. So we are starting and finishing at Stephen's Green. And I am so excited. People have been so nice sending good wishes. I've seen people coming in to line the streets already. So the atmosphere is going to be electric around the city for the next few hours.
We wish you the very best. If you're anywhere along that route and you see a very fast young woman in a purple shirt.
It's not me.
And you mentioned the causes. You're doing it for the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. If people want to, because you can, I assume you can still donate if people want to.
You can. And every single cent is going to this organisation that's been doing incredible work since 1979. They need around €77,000 every week in terms of fundraising to keep doing what they do. If you have €2, €20, €200, whatever it is, please consider going to idonate.ie/newstalkofftheball. Every single cent makes a difference.
And what time? You said you're starting half 12?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you hang around, Valerie's going to be out at around about 5 to 11. You can deal with the GPS and the dog thing outside.
No problem. Sure, do it with me, Valerie. We can talk about it around the 10K. Is that okay? Bring the dog. Do bring the dog.
Jess, best of luck. Hope it goes well. Thank you so much. All right. So setting Valerie your dog's GPS to one side for a minute. There's very interesting coverage in the Sunday Independent. Sunday Indo, of course, does these big Ireland Thinks polls on a regular basis where they break down sort of opinion around politics, around the general issues, all the rest of it. And whenever you do a political poll, the politician's response is, oh, snapshot in time, it is but a single poll, all the rest of it. In this instance, what we have now is a very clear trend line. People are deserting Sinn Féin in significant numbers and they're heading for independence. Why?
Well, it's a very interesting situation. And I mean, there's a lot being written about it this morning. One of the things we're talking about here, and Jodie Corcoran has written an awful lot of stuff on this, is the fact that traditional Ireland is declaring for the independence and moving away from Sinn Féin. I mean, you know, people got fed up with Fianna Fáil. What did they do? They moved to Sinn Féin. Now they're moving back again. And in fact, Jodie has a wonderful piece here where he's trying to describe the sort
of
people.
Isn't it brilliant?
It's brilliant. They're going to, the people are going to vote for the independence. And he quotes the late Mark Killalay, who said, you know, the people who, the people of rural Ireland, and Mark Killalay, of course, was Fianna Fáil. And he said, Mark described them with affection as people who ate their dinner in the middle of the day. And then, of course, in the noughties, they bought into the Tiger. There were men who got in Sky Sports and took their mother-in-law out to Sunday dinner. They discovered cappuccinos. They took up golf in the golf clubs. And they began to wear brands and they took their wives to Kildare Village. And they got a new rig out for their cousin's wedding. I mean, all of that sort of thing.
And
it's
Shane Lowry is there.
Actually,
But now it's worth saying in that this is not Jodie's assumption of who he thinks there is. This is what the demographic breakdown in terms of social demographics, gender, all the rest of it. That's what the data is saying.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. But I think part of it is, you know, years ago we just had independence. Today we've got lots of different types of independence. And some of those independents have become very, very well known in the Dáil, in public, whatever. And they've been very colourful compared with the party, people towing the party line, because they've had the freedom to do that. Mm. I mean, I'm in Mick Wallace's constituency and even look at his posters. I mean, they're like something that Banksy would be having a go at. He may not get back, of course. I mean, that's coming through very clearly. Himself and Claire Daly's seats could be actually in danger. But I also think there's something that we're not looking at very clearly here, which is that in the last general election, and, you know, there's not too many comparisons because we're talking the European elections and we're talking the local elections. But in the last general election, the results were very much skewed by the fact that although Sinn Féin did so well, their votes generally didn't transfer that much. And that can make an enormous difference as well. I mean, all the papers are saying, yes, Mary Lou is in serious trouble. Where is she going to go from here? I mean, the numbers, I mean, last time, where are the numbers? I had them. Yeah, the last time Sinn Féin had 22% support. And that, sorry, that's what they have now. And that is the lowest since October 22. And also in this poll, in the Sunday Independent, the support for a government made up of Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Independents, that's actually supported by 59% of the people, which is a very, very high figure. So Sinn Féin could be in trouble. But again, they're going to say, well, you won't know until we actually get out there and count the votes.
Well, going back to Jodie Corcoran's analysis, Peter, because one of the things that he says in it is he talks about the Phil Hogan quote about borrowing that vote originally from Fianna Fáil, that when there was the big Endicenny upsurge after the disaster of the financial crisis, that vote, the ones that Valerie described, came across from Fianna Fáil to Fine Gael. Sinn Féin had been borrowing from them for the last year or so very successfully. How come they seem to have moved away from the party? Because Sinn Féin had huge momentum and looked like it was doing everything right.
Well, I suppose it's very hard to say why that has happened, Anton. But obviously, there has been a major shift. Now, I mean, you said there that when an opinion poll comes out, all the political parties say, ah, sure, that's only a snapshot in a point in time. But actually, it's quite significant now because we have an election. So polling day is next Friday. So this is an assessment that's being done by the Sunday Independent just 6 days out. Now, I suppose we should always say that it's a very small section of people. I think it's 1,700 people nationwide, about 500 people in Dublin, and then the rest divided between the other two constituencies, Midland North West and Ireland South. So, I mean, it is only a snapshot in one way, but it is reflective, and the margin of error is 2.4%. When the election votes are counted on Friday, Sinn Féin will have a better election. They had a dreadful election in 2019. They lost two MEPs, Lynn Boylan in Dublin and Leah O'Riordan in Ireland South. So if they gain back a seat in each of the constituencies, it will be a good day for them. I mean, that's the way it will be spun. However, up to maybe 15 months ago, they were riding high on 37%, according to the opinion polls. But that's midterm. Doesn't really matter. It's now, you know, what are people going to do when they have to make a decision? So it would appear that there's a bit of a bounce for Simon Harris as well. He seems to be getting some kudos. I think, you know, he's had a lot of publicity. I mean, that's Taoiseach. He's going to get loads of publicity anyway. But clearing tents from the Grand Canal, making that declaration on...
Although clearing them only as far as them moving to Herbert Park, we see in the papers yesterday.
But I think it's reflected in kind of him being active, doing something. If you know what I mean. I mean, at the end of the day, it's, as you say, it's putting a sticking plaster on a big wound. But maybe the, you know, declaring Irish support for independent Palestine, etc. That sort of stuff. There seems to be a bounce for him. And if you look at the polling for Fine Gael candidates, they seem to be topping the poll, according to the Sunday Indo, in all the various different constituencies. You know, it's doing OK. Fianna Fáil are doing OK as well. The big story, as I said, is Sinn Féin falling back. But they will do better than they did in 2019. And that will be the take next Friday.
It's worth caveating just the data that we're giving, because the Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll, when they ask about preferences for the parties, they're asking in an upcoming general election. And of course, there's additional nuances then when you get to Europe and when you get to the locals. And a lot of the analysis saying that when you include unpredictable transfers in a lot of the European constituencies, it's still very much anybody's game and very difficult to predict. Some of the analysis in the paper, Nivarelli, suggests that Mary Lou has been invisible. I think it's David Davenport's writing that she hasn't been as present as she had been in previous months, and that perhaps in some way that's contributing to the softening of the vote.
Yeah, I think she is such an important part of the party, and she has been so visible and she has been so vocal, and, you know, up until recently, you know, a lot of people were saying she could be the first, you know, female Taoiseach. And she has been notably, I think, a little bit absent. And you'd wonder what's behind that. You'd wonder why. But I think, you know, she is a very, very important part, you know, of how they are going to do. So I think, given what's in the opinion polls and the results today, I think she would need to maybe get out there and show her face a little bit more. And it's unlike her not to do that. She's a very sort of upfront, you know, out there sort of person who wouldn't be behind the door, you know, in saying what she thinks. And so it's interesting that she sort of has gone a little bit missing.
Texts say, I was a soft Sinn Féin voter and their fall in popularity isn't surprising from calling it wrong in the two recent referenda. Well, everybody was at that, I think, except Aintu. Mary Lou snubbing the Dublin bombing memorial in favour of fundraising in the US. Difficult positions on immigration, lacklustre dull performances. Sinn Féin is a mess. By trying to appeal to everybody, the party is at a risk of mattering to no one. Well, let's not forget, it is still the largest party by popularity in the state.
It is, yes. But I think, you know, as Niamh says, the fact that Mary Lou hasn't been very visible is really not helping. But there is some speculation in the papers today that perhaps the party is concentrating too much on Northern Ireland and winning seats up there, that this is their priority and not down in the south. And there's another piece that says that maybe Mary Lou thought it was all sewn up in the south and they were perfectly safe and she didn't really have to do very much. And there's a third field, which says, well, maybe if Mary Lou stays very, very quiet, they'll do very well.
Maybe.
There's a little bit of mischief in the Sunday Indo where they're saying, well, what if she was to be replaced?
Yeah.
You know, and kind of an alternative candidate. And we know Sinn Féin don't do open elections for leadership because they generally decide that internally. And that's the way it goes. I think it's just it's easy, I suppose, when there's nothing at stake to be populist and to have a go all the time. And now just when people have to focus on actually voting, maybe people are kind of weighing up their vote a little bit. Curiously, though, if you look at the poll in the Sunday Indo, it says that the most important issue for voters is housing. And that's at 56%. And then you drop to 33% or something for immigration. So Sinn Féin have always been strong on housing. Immigration was deemed to be maybe more problematic for them in the sense that they were changing their view and that they felt that they were trying to move with the crowd in relation to that. So housing still seems to be the big issue. So that wouldn't be consistent with the fact that the party is dropping in popularity.
And it's interesting to see the way those issues have gone, because some of the ones that you would have assumed would always be hardy perennials, like the economy, only 6% of people suggesting that they care much about the economy as a voting issue. I assume that is because the general consensus is that it is going relatively well. But effectively, we have the four things: housing, immigration, cost of living, and healthcare. They're the ones that people are concerned about.
Yeah. I wasn't surprised to see healthcare there. In fact, I thought it might have even been a bit higher because the controversy, of course, at the moment with the National Children's Hospital as well. But there's been so many horror stories about healthcare. And particularly now at the moment, we've had a number of senior clinicians come out and comment themselves, whereas normally they always remain behind closed doors, never said anything about the situation. Because we're really at crisis point with healthcare. Our hospitals are crowded.
But is it ever thus, Valerie? When have we not been?
No. It's never been as bad as this. And I have sat with somebody for 3 days and three nights in A&E waiting to be seen. And the scenes I saw were absolutely horrific. You cannot name the staff, of course.
No.
But they were horrific. I saw one 90-year-old woman, I know because I was talking to her relative, and they were keeping her in, but they didn't have a bed. They didn't have a trolley. They sat her on a chair and they gave her a pillow and told her to balance it against the wall and try and get some sleep.
Come on. That's
now, when we are doing that to our oldest and most vulnerable people, as a nation, we are absolutely crap, uncaring. And I don't know how you change it, but the people in power who can change it, the people we've elected as our government, are certainly doing a really, really bad job. Mm. And, you know, Stephen Donnelly, Simon Harris himself. I mean, all of these people have experience of the healthcare system. And, you know, the fact that it's down a bit, I don't know that it's going to affect the elections anyway, because we're talking local government, we're talking Europe. I think it's in the national elections that that's going to become an issue. I don't think it's going to be a really serious issue in this election.
But it's interesting, I mean, where we talk about those four being the critical ones: healthcare, cost of living, immigration and housing. Housing is, according to this, by a country mile the most significant in this election.
It's like it is. It's such, I mean, I think probably we all know people who are stuck at home and, you know, they can't afford to buy a house and, you know, they're married and they might have children and they're living with their parents or their in-laws and, you know, it's impossible. And if you're trying to save for your deposit, for your house and try and pay rent as well, I mean, the options in front of you are really, really bleak, you know, and housing, it's without question, I think the thing that affects everybody. We all need somewhere to live. But it just has become so far out of reach for so many people who are working. They have good jobs, both partners in the relationship are working, you know, full time. They're doing everything they're supposed to be doing and they still can't get a house.
I think it's even worse for single people. I really do. Yeah. Because it's impossible, really, unless you're on enormous
money.
It's
totally impossible. If a couple can't do it.
And the awful thing is that people are having to put their lives on hold as well.
They are.
I mean, there are people who are afraid to have children.
Yeah.
Or they say, we'll do it 5 years down the road.
But you mightn't be able to do it 5 years down the road.
Exactly.
It's really, it's not right.
And that's not the way you should be living your life. It's appalling.
It isn't. And then people are having children later, and that has a lot of knock-on effects as well, you know, for your life. You know, a lot of women are having their first children, you know, now in their mid-40s and that sort of thing. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it does add other pressures, you know, onto your life.
Well, given that you are an officer of the court, Peter, let me start with you on this one. We have a convicted felon, 34 counts, felony convictions in the form of Donald Trump. And the Republican Party are falling over themselves to say that who is actually at fault is the entire American judicial system.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that have to be said. I think, first of all, to the fact that he was found guilty on all 34 counts is very significant. I think the fact that it was decided by a jury of 12 jurors is very significant again. I mean, it is incredible from a distance here, from this side of the pond, looking at Donald Trump coming out and saying the judge is corrupt and the whole thing is corrupt. And I mean, the commentary he is making about the judge is appalling. I thought Joe Biden was on very solid ground when he came out and said, look, this is the judicial system. Nobody is ahead of the law. Everybody is treated equally. And just because he was a former president doesn't mean that he's going to get any special treatment. And I thought that resonated. I mean, of course, in the Republican base that are supportive of Trump, this is another rallying call. You know, let's gather around our man who's been unfairly treated. You know, I mean, the irony is he comes out and he won't respect the court, but then he says, I'm standing by the Constitution. So there's inherent contradictions in all of that. My view is that that will just embed the Republican support that he has. I mean, he's going to get 40 plus support in the election. I don't believe it'll carry him over the line. I really don't. And I think when it comes down to it, there's enough independent voters. There'll be, you know, half will go for Biden, half will go for Trump. But I think what has happened here and the fact that he is a convicted felon, that's not a huge offence. It's a misdemeanor and it's you know, but it has greater. It's a felony and it has, you know, it has greater magnitude because of who he is. But I think ultimately it will affect enough people that will deny him getting back to the White House. That's my view.
Can I ask about the magnitude of the implications outside of politics just for a second before we go back to the political thing? If you look at what happened when he stood against and when he decided to say me versus the electoral system, two people wound up dead. An Air Force member was shot trying to get into the Congress. A police officer was killed in the scuffles and Congress was, the Capitol building was besieged. Surely having a former president throw the entire judicial system under the bus and discovering that half of the voters in America accept that, that has to be massively damaging for American democracy and judiciary.
But it is. The only thing is that it continues on. And I think people don't take what he says seriously. I mean, they can't.
Don't they?
Well, I think they should. I know he says crazy things. And like since 2016, I feel like we've all been living in a really, really strange, surreal nightmare sometimes when it comes to Trump, and he says crazy things and you think, ah, you know, he's just saying them. But if he gets back in and he holds the power, there's nothing, I mean, there's not very much to stop him following through on some of these.
Well, the only thing is he was there before. He was there before for 4 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, it would appear that there were people around him who were officially kind of his advisors and people that that were working at his direction. But they were basically bypassing him and taking decisions to ensure that America remained safe and functioned properly. And I mean, the ultimate sign.
But hang on for a minute, Peter. Hang on. He was there before and that period ended with him setting the record for the first president in American history to be twice impeached and a mob storming the Capitol with a gallows attempting to hang the vice president. I wouldn't have thought pointing back to the 4 year period and saying, well, sure, it didn't.
No,
that one wasn't that bad.
Yeah, but remember, there was kind of national security advisors, for example, you know, and I mean, he's liable to do anything, you know. But they were there and there were kind of safeguards put in place where they said, look, no, we can't use the military. I think so. I mean, like,
He held a two-part, let's not defancy it, meeting with Vladimir Putin with no advisors present whatsoever. We've no record of what occurred at
that. But that was kind of like a PR interaction. I mean, I'm not defending Trump at all. I mean, I'm saying it's appalling.
You got a MAGA hat there.
If that sounds what it's like, what I'm saying is that there was a kind of an infrastructure around him which denied kind of the craziness of his decision making. And I think it's the same thing with this. You're talking about the judicial system being under attack. It's not under attack because what happened was in New York, it performed perfectly. He was brought before the case. The DA brought the charges against him. There were 34 charges brought against him. He was heard by a jury of his peers. He was given every opportunity to defend himself. And the net result was that he was found guilty in all 34 counts. So the system works, and it's the same thing. So he is an individual. As president, he has ultimate power. But what I was saying was, in the background, there were people who were kind of keeping an eye on him and making sure he didn't do crazy stuff.
Well, Valerie? I pressed the nuclear button. I read something somewhere that said that he's actually got a fake button in his little suitcase.
And he gets off on probably pressing it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's there's only 2% between himself and Biden. And I mean, my God, if you look at the choice, the two of them. I mean, this is the problem with the elections, yeah, particularly in a place like America, because you've got so many primaries and so on that you actually end up with the lowest common denominators. Yeah. And that is what happens. And people like Trump, who is a bully, who has vast sums of money and can manipulate the electorate, these people are going to come to the top by virtue of that, and not because they're good people.
So,
and that is actually quite scary. Also, since Trump took up office last time, the world is a much scarier place. We're in a much more dangerous world. Awful things have happened. I mean, who could have predicted what happened in Gaza? We would have said rubbish, you know, the UN is going to wade in, Europe's going to wade in, we're going to stop all of that happening. And this has happened on our doorstep.
Yeah.
Look at Ukraine. You know, it's a much more dangerous place. And I think he could do an awful lot of damage. I don't understand.
Although, hang on for a minute, Valerie, people will surely, I mean, Trump supporters will point to the fact of the period of Trump's presidency was relatively peaceful globally. You didn't have the Ukrainian war during Trump's presidency. You didn't have the Hamas attack during Trump's presidency. You didn't have the Israeli reprisals during Trump's presidency.
I don't think any of that was due to Trump. I really don't. I mean, that was forces way beyond his control at that stage. I mean, we'd never have had Ukraine if Putin hadn't risen up okay. But Trump was hardly controlling him in his first term of office. I mean, Trump really didn't have that influence. He was much more interested in domestic policies than he was in international politics. But I think it's more dangerous this time because Trump could do an awful lot more damage.
It's very disheartening.
Peter is suggesting that he thinks that Trump is not going to get back in and that there would be a slightly undermining it.
Genuinely, I think when it comes down to it, I think he will not be elected.
Now, how come then, Niamh, what we are seeing off the back of this conviction is that it seems to have strengthened his position, that a lot of the polls are saying people are now more committed to him because this is seen as martyrdom.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy to me. But this, you know, this trial, I think no matter what the outcome, was always going to play into his playbook. Whether he was found not guilty, it would have been, okay, I'm not guilty. But being found guilty, it's like, oh, everyone's trying to attack me. The system is corrupt. I'm the one standing with freedom. I'm the patriot, blah, 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 blah. So all of this plays right into sort of his hands. And, you know, the stuff that he's spouting and the people that are believing it, it is just crazy to me. But I think if you look at America now, I think it's so disconnected. And I was reading Larry Donnelly the other day and, you know, he made a really good point that, you know, he's from Boston and sort of, you know, he's making the point that his upbringing and sort of his life there has more in common with people in Ireland than someone in rural Idaho. It's a very, very, it's a big country. It's a very different country and different views. And I think it's getting even more divided, you know, as time goes on. And
the opinion, to come in there, Anton, I think the opinion polls suggest that just over 50% of American people believe it was a fair and just outcome in the trial. And there's only about 35% who are core Trumpers. Remember, you're never going to shift those guys. Doesn't matter what you say about them. I mean, Trump famously said, if I went down Fifth Avenue and shot somebody, they'd still vote for me. And that is the case. But it's the margins. Remember, it's the swing states and it's all about the swing states.
35% is a big margin though, Peter.
No, but I mean, well, that's the core vote. He has that. But I mean, Biden has that in core vote. And I mean, Valerie's point about, you know, are they either of them an attractive candidate?
No, they're not.
At the end of the day, people will, I think, you know, I mean, Biden is, you know, because of Gaza, et cetera.
Why do we equate the two?
Sorry?
Why do we equate the two? You're all saying neither of them are attractive.
But like, if I was an American voter and these were my options, it's sort of grumpy old white man versus slightly grumpier old white man. I find that, I mean, is that really the best they have to offer?
With serious health issues as well.
With serious health issues and whatever, I don't know about any other things you want to say about them. But, I mean, that is such a turn-off for, you know, a regular American.
The other
voter
way to characterise it is to say man responsible for highest rate of job creation, or one of the highest rates of job creation in recent American history, a booming economy, one of the better setups of American healthcare that we have had probably in the last 100 years, versus a man who has been convicted of lying to falsify his business records to cheat a bank, of sexually assaulting a woman and then defaming her, and of 34 counts of paying
and
off a porn star
and three outstanding
to influence an election.
Other possible.
Are they, do you equate the two?
But I think Biden has a difficulty with Gaza, and I think that has kind of internationally that has had an impact. You know, people looking at it from a distance are kind of concerned about that. I mean, there obviously are concerns about his age and his fitness for the job. But you're right. Domestically, he has been an incredibly successful president. There's no doubt about that.
But he hasn't managed to capitalise on it. That seems to be the remarkable thing. It is a plague on both their houses. There is no sense that he's been able to capitalise on any of his... of that success.
Yeah, I think that is a factor of his age to a certain extent. I think America is a little concerned about this man who is older, and you know there have been issues in relation to speeches, etc.
But there's one again, Valerie.
But there's also the polarisation, Anton.
But
I think the polarisation
issue
is huge.
He's 4 years older than Donald Trump. They are effectively peers in age, and Donald Trump has never been synonymous with the smoothness of verbal dexterity.
It's not really just the age, though. It really isn't. It's your state of health, your state of mind, all of that kind of thing, and you know whether you're capable of the job. It's not just age related as such. Yes, they're both quite old men, but I mean, there are huge similarities. I mean, looking at photos of Trump, if I was his GP, I'd be hauling him in for a few tests now, you know. And he seems to be getting angrier and angrier. And do you notice how his face just gets really red?
Yeah.
I mean,
orange and red.
Yeah, orangey red.
It's a weird combo.
You wouldn't have known that back in the days of black and white television, you know.
Yeah.
But we can watch. And there's a vein keeps kind of throbbing in his neck.
Popping out.
This is a level of detail I don't think I can wade through. Saying the biggest problem with Trump is not the undermining or questioning of the judiciary. It's the fact that his platform for 24 has no vision for the country and is about vengeance, both for the 2020 result and the hush money ruling. In his first big week, he'll pull whatever he levers he can to punish those who rejected the big lie simply to soothe his own ego. Although he did the same with promising to jail Hillary Clinton in the previous election and played very well with the electorate. Simon Harris, this relates to where we were talking earlier in our own upcoming election. Simon Harris was the Minister for Health at one point and is rarely questioned on his record there. Yet he's managed to fail upwards and is now Taoiseach. So failing in the Ministry of Health doesn't seem to matter. Nothing much is expected. No wonder it is a mess. That goes to health being one of the main issues that people are citing on the doors and to pollsters when asked, as they were by the Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll. On the topic of health, we mentioned this earlier on, the Children's Hospital, front page of the Mail on Sunday. We can't blacklist children's hospital builders. This is the reporting that the relationship between government and BAM, the construction company responsible for the children's hospital, has come so far apart that apparently the cabinet would like to blacklist them from ever getting public contracts, something they cannot do. Valerie, this story that the Mail is reporting, thanks to John Lee, Nicola Byrne and John Drennan, says that the state has become so irked with the builders of the National Children's Hospital that they want to preclude them ever getting state contracts again.
Yeah, although apparently they're quite powerless in doing that because they can't stop people applying for public contracts due to the EU procurement plans. But what I find very strange about this is we didn't have due diligence, obviously, when we were handing out these contracts. Now, BAM is involved in several projects in Ireland and making a lot of money from Ireland. It's obviously, and abroad, it's a Dutch company. But what's very strange is the Mail on Sunday has produced this list of projects that BAM has been involved in, where they ended up either costing millions more than the initial cost, or running years and years after the expected conclusion date. Now, many of these were before the contract was signed for the National Children's Hospital. So why did our politicians They didn't get in there and investigate this company. If I was handing out a contract for €1,000,
Sorry for a second. I can't let it go to suggest that the fact that there is an overrun is intrinsically and without question the fault of the construction company. There are a multiplicity of reasons that cause overruns. There can be unexpected things to do with the construction process. There can be changes in the spec. We saw it with the Children's Hospital. There were a number of changes to the specifications and requirements of the construction process. And BAM are totally within their rights to say, whoa, this changed, therefore we had to adjust accordingly.
Sure. But what I'm saying is there's a according to the Mail, there is a multiplicity of cases involving BAM where there's been problems. Now, I don't know if that's true of every construction company. I don't know anything about construction companies, but there seems to be an awful lot of them. And, you know, we're up to now 2.2 billion is the latest projected cost of the National Children's Hospital.
What
the
was original, it for?
Yeah. 650 million was the original. And now
so we're nudging four times the original projected cost.
Yeah. I mean, it's huge. But if you look at the other claims, the value of the claims paid to BAM were 27 million. That's a huge number as well. But if you just look at this, the number of things that have gone wrong, a large portion of a multi-storey car park being built in Eindhoven Airport collapsed into a pile of rubble. Then we had another one, the construction of the world's largest sea lock. And it was supposed to have been finished in 2019, but because of design errors, it was in Amsterdam, near Amsterdam Airport. It opened 3 years late with a cost overrun of 300
but
million.
But again, and that may be an issue where, as case in point, it could be the design rather than the construction.
Maybe,
so there is
not.
Always a multiplicity of factors.
Maybe they're indicators.
One issue in this, Peter, is this, if you are BAM, would you not look at this and say, look, if we are in a situation where we have to, where it'll be awarded to, I think, what is the most economically advantageous tender? That means effectively the cheapest.
Yes.
That means that if there is any variation, you have to hit the contracting organisation with fines and with penalties. Otherwise, you don't get paid. You're already on the bone. That's the procurement system's fault, is it not?
Well, it is. I mean, this is kind of a bizarre report, I find, in the Mail on Sunday. Now, it's an excellent report. There's loads of detail in it. And they go through the history of the hospital, going back to 2014. Remember when Bertie wanted it built in the Mater Hospital? And then 2015, it transferred over to the St. James's site. BAM came on board in 2016 and said, we're going to build that for you for 650 million, which I think everybody says now is kind of an unrealistic figure. And then there were delays and planning delays and all that sort of stuff. And then everything got more expensive and all that sort of stuff. I find, though, this notion that the government are trying to blacklist BAM bizarre. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, unless they engaged in something like fraud or criminal conduct. Other than that, they're a commercial entity. Whether they're good or bad, that's a different matter. You don't blacklist somebody. You just go to the competitor. That's the way it goes. Interestingly, there's a quote in it, which I thought was kind of unusual from Micheál Martin, who's always very cautious in what he says. But he says that he's quoted in the Mail on Sunday today as saying, this is likely to be part of a commercial strategy to try and extract more money and more funding from the Irish people. That's a big statement. I'm kind of surprised at that. But within the procurement process, as you say, Anton, there are loads of penalties, and BAM are going to be fixed with loads of penalties for failing to meet deadlines and failing to do what they're supposed to do. And there are various different contractual checks and balances that have to be met, and BAM have not met those, so they're going to be in trouble. Now, the cost is crazy. 650 against 2.2 billion. I see that currently, as we speak in 2004, there are supposed to be 5,000 rooms in this hospital. No, wards or whatever it is. Only 60 are currently finished. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something like 1,500 are close to being finished, but they're talking about 2026. So it's taken way too long. It's crazy. It's a disaster. But blacklisting the company, I don't think so. It is a Dutch company originally, so they're trying to say, well, we'll do this at EU level. That's not going to happen.
And it's funny, Brendan O'Connor writing in the front of the Sunday Indo uses an analogy around doing your own house development, saying there is a point of peak where the builder hates the client, hates the builder. You wish you'd never started this. And the kind of fights that you have about, can I have a second socket over there? When you scale them up to children's hospital size, it's not surprising that you get conflict. Just the scale of this conflict seems pretty large.
Yeah, I mean, it's the amount of money in it is colossal. The time it is taking, like we're 10 years into the project now at this stage, and now we're talking about another 4 years. I mean, that is unacceptable. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it hasn't been a good piece of work. I mean, BAM, you might say, I'm never going to employ them again, but you can't ban them.
We should go, just to go back to a thing earlier on, Valerie, you were talking about the, we were discussing the performance in terms of health and how bad things were. I'm right in saying you stood against both Stephen Donnelly and Simon Harris in the previous election, didn't you?
I did, yes.
So to some extent against the two people responsible, you have a dog in the fight.
Yes, although I have to say throughout the campaign, because I was the newbie, they were both very kind to me.
text saying, didn't the cost of steel double because of Ukraine? Mariupol was one of the biggest steel producers in the world. This is what I mean by the multifactorial nature of these things.
And there was COVID,
this
of course,
is why God gave us the courts, and it goes on for several years. Now, to the issue that looked so promising, and Valerie, you might have a view on this, that looked so promising yesterday morning because we woke to discover that there was political weight being thrown behind an apparent potential ceasefire in Israel. Biden said that it was a solution that he wanted Israel to adopt. Hamas welcomed it. Obama tweeted about it. Cameron came out in the UK to support it. It felt like there was momentum and poof.
But it fell apart, yeah. Netanyahu said it was a non-starter. And, I mean, everybody had instilled enough sort of hope into this that it might work, and I think probably it would have done Biden a lot of good in the election polls in the election as well. But really, I mean, it's tragic that we've got to this situation, that even with all of these major powers involved, that we cannot come to a peaceful solution. And against that, you know, what are we all doing? You know, it's okay for Biden to come up with something like this and the powers that be, but as a people, we just feel so helpless.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people feel like this in all the other countries involved as well, or even on way not involved, standing on the sidelines. I mean, there's so many men, women and children are just being killed so violently every day, that we have people starving because we can't get aid into them. I know that's changed very slightly, but only very slightly. I mean, how can this be happening in Europe at the moment? And to even have to rely on somebody like the American president to get involved, to get a ceasefire. And where do we go to from here? Because who's going to come up with the next plan? Who's going to agree a plan if his plan has fallen flat?
It's very hard to see how these two sides are ever going to sit down. Because that's where it ends. This only really properly ends with them sitting down.
But presumably that hinges entirely on Netanyahu.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not going to happen with him there. He doesn't have an appetite to sit down with the opposing side. There's no appetite there, I don't think. His appetite is for total victory, or, you know, inverted commas,
the
total destruction
of Hamas,
and that is all that, if from his point of view, that is what he wants and that is what he is going
to do.
But
this one, maybe I was naive. This had the feeling of positivity. I mean, it was only 24 hours ago, but it had the feeling of positivity by virtue of the fact that it seemed like political weight was coming behind it. The Obama tweet, the Cameron involvement, the Biden involvement, that felt like a deal has been done here in the back rooms. Mm. Netanyahu is clearly not for turning in any way, shape or form.
Well, you know, this thing has to come to an end, Anton. And even Netanyahu, hawkish that he is, will have to try, at some point, will have to understand that this thing has to come to an end. It's interesting, the leader of the opposition in Israel, I can't think of his name offhand, but he has come out and he has basically said, we need to support this peace deal that Biden has come up with. And I will provide you with the support necessary when all the extreme right-wing parties that are part of Netanyahu's coalition, if they object to this. So, I mean, there is a move afoot. Things are happening. I mean, Netanyahu has made his career on being a tough guy and never say no and all of that. I mean, it's crazy stuff. I mean, what has happened in Gaza is absolutely horrific. I mean, it is a country that has been absolutely destroyed.
The scale of the death,
you know, women and children is just, you know,
the most vulnerable.
Absolutely. 36,000 people killed.
Extremely vulnerable children, you know, who had nothing. I mean, the amount of children who even survive this, how traumatized are they going to be? I mean, it's going to take generations for them.
But if you look at even in the Israeli cabinet, I mean, there has been dissension in relation to what are we going to do with Gaza afterwards.
Yeah.
So this plan that Biden has come up with seems fairly comprehensive. I mean, it is talking about
an administration.
I don't think so. I mean, these things happen. Hamas were favourable towards it. So that is significant, I think. Netanyahu is saying no, but that has to be his initial response. Let's see what happens. I think pressure is going to come on him from the international community. And there has to be an end game. There has to be. So it looks to me as if there is still some road left in this plan.
Texas say in relation to BAM, Anton, BAM is in reality an Irish company. The Dutch parent company BAM bought a large Irish company, that being Ascon Limited. They're very well known, but all large construction and civil companies have to claim because clients change things and designers make mistakes, and that leads obviously to the claims process. In all of the coverage, by the way, and the hospital stuff, did we see an end deadline at which this thing, because it feels like it's been going on since God was
I just want my children not to be on the pension by the time this thing opens. I mean, really, it just seems like it goes on and on and on and on. And my children are probably going to be out of the window of being children to actually use this thing when it opens.
We've missed a generation.
You know, we've missed a generation and they still have to, I mean...
And more. I mean, if we go back to the original debates about, do you remember the debates about the site of whether it would be co-located between the Mater and Temple Street? I think we're back into the 90s when all that crack started, aren't we?
Probably.
Probably would have been, yeah.
Guys, thank you so much. Undoubtedly, there is sunshine that you should be sitting in. Very grateful that you're willing to come in on a bank holiday. Don't forget, if you're passing on the way out, if you're heading south side, wave to Jess Kelly as she runs past.
Yes, and will. Send her money.
Exactly, yes. Send her money, the two things. Valerie Cox, journalist and author, Niamh O'Reilly, freelance journalist, and Peter Leonard, barrister and presenter of the Fifth Court podcast. Thank you all.
The Anton Savage Show
with Kiri's.ie
on News Talk.
American Log Homes and Cabins is assisting a developer in liquidating several of our kits that have deposits on them for only the balance owed. Most of these will save you more than half of the original cost. An example. Our Augusta model, normally $42,450, is being sold for $16,500. Our Biloxi model, normally $36,825, is being sold for $14,500. This includes delivery, excluding California, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Idaho, Alaska, and Hawaii, but we will pay partial shipping to those states. These kits have not been manufactured, and there's no time limit on delivery. This is a log home kit that includes complete blueprints from foundation details to roof, stack sheets, and a construction manual. Any do-it-yourselfer or builder can erect the logs. Kits do not include any part or roof, windows, or doors. Please call 704-602-3035 for availability. You can also visit our website at www.AmericanLogHomesAndCabins.com.